Welcome to episode 114 of the People's History of Ideas podcast. When we ended the last episode, the 4th and 5th Red Armies had just reunited in Roy Jean, where they received a very important letter from the party center. I want to take a close look at both the letter from the party center that Mao received on April 3rd, 1929, and also at the response that Mao sent back 2 days later. These are both important documents which demonstrate how major actors in the Chinese Revolution were thinking, in sometimes divergent ways, about how to give concrete, practical form to grand strategic visions of the revolution. So let's start with the letter from the party center. That letter was written by Zhou Enlai in his capacity as head of the organization department of the Central Committee on February 7th, 1929. One point to keep in mind when we read this letter was that it was written with very little concrete knowledge about what was going on with the Fourth Red Army. Mao's November 25th, 1928 report to the Central Committee, which we discussed in episode 98, had not reached the party center in Shanghai. Zhou Enlai had only just gotten back in November from attending the Sixth Party Congress in Moscow, and so, having only received limited intelligence about the activities of the Fourth Red Army since then, we can assume that his views about the activities of Mao Zedong and Zhu De had not changed much since he had given his report on military affairs at the Sixth Party Congress. In that report, Zhou Enlai observed that Mao had had a sizable armed force at the time of the Autumn Harvest Risings, but that he was continually flying from place to place, and that his forces had a bandit character. And now he was moving along the Hunan-Jiangxi border with an estimated force of not more than 1,000. So, as we can see, Zhou did not have a particularly favorable opinion of what Mao was doing at this time, and this opinion reflected both the imperfect information that Zhou had at his disposal, as well as the urban bias that Zhou Enlai held at the time regarding how the revolutionary process should unfold. Okay, here's Zhou Enlai's letter. Comrades Runjie and Yujie and the Hunan-Jiangxi Border Region Special Committee. To clarify here, Runjie is Mao Zedong and Yujie is Zhu De. Quote, the new CC, CC is short for Central Committee, elected by the party's 6th Congress, has returned home and has taken charge of the work during the last half a year. During this period, we have sent several letters to you via couriers, but have never received any replies. We are extremely anxious. 2 months ago, the West Jiangxi Special Committee sent us a note which said that they had lost a report from you to the CC, as well as the letter from the CC to you via them. It is very likely that someone in their committee has stolen the two messages and given them to the enemy. They are now investigating the case carefully. However, we are afraid that it has already damaged your work, since the information contained in the two messages would certainly help the enemy arrange attacks on you. End quote. I want to highlight the suspicion of enemy infiltration of the West Jiangxi Special Committee. The suspicion of enemy infiltration is going to come to a head with a particularly ugly set of events in 1930 and 1931. For now, the letter moves on from this, but keep in mind that this is an issue that's going to come back up in a big way. The next two paragraphs here are summarized from the actual letter. Now, the editor of the document collection that I'm using, Tony Seitch, doesn't clarify as to whether he is the one who did the summarizing or whether the summary is in the copy of the letter that he translated from the document collection put together by the Central Party Archives in China. Judging from the content, my guess is that the summary was done by the Central Party Archives. It's not at all unknown for documents dealing with Communist Party history to be presented in incomplete form when printed for a public audience. Anyways, here it is. Our task on the international front at this stage is to oppose the coming world war, as well as the attempt to divide China and defend the Chinese Revolution. The conflicts among the various imperialist countries have become increasingly intensified. The confrontation between Britain and the United States will be the focus of the future world war. the turmoil in China indicates that the bourgeois regime will collapse soon. Party work in the cities has been weakened further, and we only have a real presence in Shanghai and Hong Kong. In the countryside in the south, party organizations have developed somewhat, but they are very volatile. The party's proletarian base is weakened, and its cadres destroyed by the white terror. Our weakness prevents us from taking advantage of even favorable circumstances to bring about a revolutionary high tide. The current stage of the revolution is bourgeois democratic, with the ultimate goal of overthrowing the rule of the landlords and the bourgeoisie. It is certain that the Chinese Revolution will advance eventually to the socialist stage. The Sixth Congress decided that our party's central task at present is to win the support of the people. The party's major task at present is to establish and develop bases among the proletariat, mainly to establish branches among the industrial workers and to mobilize the masses. This does not mean that we will not expand the rural revolution or direct spontaneous peasant uprisings or ignore guerrilla warfare. Indeed, these should be adjusted to fit with the central work of the party. Okay, that's the end of the summarized section. One thing to note here is that, again, we see the Comintern analysis that we saw in episode 102 when we talked about Bukharin's speech at the Sixth Congress of the Chinese Communist Party in June 1928. This idea that the coming world war was going to be between the United States and Britain. Another thing to note in this summary is that Zhou Enlai says, look, our organization in the cities has basically been smashed, but our central task is still in the cities, and in particular, to develop bases among the proletariat. It's interesting to see how Mao responds to this assertion in his reply, so we'll come back to this point then. What follows the summarized portion of the letter is a fairly long paragraph in which Zhou Enlai gives instructions on how the Fourth Army should deploy its forces. Here it is. Quote, in view of this background, the armed forces under your direction should also reconsider their present task and act in accordance with the political situation throughout the country as a whole and with the party's task. In line with the decision of the Sixth Congress, the CC has said for a long time that you must make plans gradually to divide the Red Army troops into small detachments and scatter them over the countryside of the Hunan-Jiangxi border area to carry out the rural revolution. The CC asks you to follow this instruction because the current political situation in China demands us to wage an extensive struggle in the countryside. This strategy can also help you divert the enemy's attention, solve the supply problem, and prepare for protracted warfare. However, you either did not receive this instruction or you are not willing to follow it. In your current operations, you have continued to adopt the tactics of concentrating forces. Of course, being surrounded by the enemy, you certainly have to amass the troops. However, the CC holds that you must clearly understand the current political situation and the party's tasks and firmly carry out the plan to disperse the forces in an orderly way. At the same time, you must also realize that the CC by no means orders you to take the pessimistic attitude to send Red Army soldiers back home. What we ask you to do is to scatter our armed forces into villages when the time and conditions are favorable. That is, when there is no serious threat of the enemy's attack. The dispersion of forces should be conducted in accordance with the enemy's military deployment, the fighting capability of our troops, and the local conditions. Depending on circumstances, a detachment can be composed of several dozen or several hundred people, but it should be no larger than 500 people. Of course, this is not a fixed figure. These scattered detachments must link up with one another and operate in close cooperation. They should mix as much as possible with the local peasants, mobilize the daily struggle of the masses, and wage a widespread rural revolution. Now, you must follow this instruction, regardless of whether your army remains in the Sanan area of South Jiangxi or has already retreated into East Hunan. Otherwise, moving from one place to another, your army will gradually become isolated from the daily struggle of the broad masses and become estranged from the peasants. When the revolutionary high tide comes, the more concentrated the Red Army armed forces are, the greater contribution they can make to the revolution. However, at this moment, the situation is entirely different. What we need to do now is to plan carefully to make sure that our army can survive the enemy's attack. Although sometimes we must concentrate the forces on the battlefield, we must never mass our troops to provide the enemy with a large target. Circumscribed by the environment, the Red Army in the Haifeng Lufeng area, that, by the way, is the base area that Peng Pai had created in Guangdong, and at Chongya at Hainan Island, tended to stay together. As a result, they were easily routed by the enemy and large numbers were decimated. The armed forces under the Hunan Jiangxi Border Region Special Committee must bear this lesson in mind. Once defeated by the enemy, you should immediately disperse the forces and scatter them into the villages so as to preserve their strength. If you plan to retreat to the Fujian Guangdong border area, you must give the matter further thought. Since most of the soldiers in your army are from Hunan and Jiangxi, it would be difficult for them to mix with the peasants in Fujian and Guangdong. Thus, it might be necessary to concentrate the forces there. However, you should still make every effort to adopt guerrilla warfare tactics and to mobilize the peasants, and you must never follow the ways of the army of the Taiping Rebellion. During the last half a year, the peasant struggle in South Fujian has developed quite rapidly, particularly the insurrection in Yongding. It lasted 6 months. Although it has now failed, its forces have not been wiped out. In addition, the struggle is not only limited to Yongding, but has spread over a large area. There are party organizations in many counties there. If indeed you move to South Fujian, you ought to make a special effort to help the development and expansion of the peasant struggle. End quote. Mao is going to have a very concrete rebuttal to Zhou Enlai's general guidance in his April 5th response. So most of this we will address when we see what Mao says in response. But there's one sentence here with a very loaded reference, which I want to unpack. It's where Zhou Enlai says that you must never follow the ways of the army of the Taiping Rebellion. What exactly is meant by this? Basically, it's the idea that the Red Army should operate as a kind of large-scale mobile force for guerrilla warfare, even more so than it already did, and that the Taiping Revolution had a form of military organization that was particularly well-suited to guerrilla warfare and, in the minds of some Chinese communist leaders, more suited to guerrilla warfare than the Fourth Red Army's current form of organization. Here's some background on this idea. On May 25, 1928, the Central Committee had issued a directive titled Outline of Military Work. This directive ordered the Red Army to reorganize itself according to the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom pattern of organization, to use the precise wording. When this directive finally arrived in the Jinggangshan, Mao had been unable to decode it. And so in his November 25, 1928 report to the Central Committee, Mao said that, quote, "We are unable to decode the Central Committee's resolution on military work and are unable to guess at the organization of the army of the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom. Please prepare another copy of the document and send it to us so as to facilitate discussion," end quote. Then, despite not knowing the content of the Central Committee's directive, the idea that the Red Army should copy the military organization of the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom was brought up as a motion to be discussed at the Sixth Congress of Party Representatives of the Fourth Red Army in early December 1928. But because the Congress had to adjourn earlier than planned, no decisions were made on the motion. Now, we can see here that Zhou Enlai, in the February 7th, 1929 letter, appears to be rescinding this order from the Central Committee. However, in the coming months, we're going to see this idea come back up. You might remember from earlier episodes that the General Secretary of the Communist Party, Xiang Zhongfa, was a relatively ineffectual figure. So, while Xiang was formally the top party leader, in reality, Zhou Enlai and another leading communist, Li Lisan, were in a contest with each other for practical leadership of the party throughout 1929 and up until April 1930. Li Lisan started to get the upper hand in June 1929 and ultimately took control in April 1930 when Zhou Enlai went to Moscow. When academic historians discuss this period, it's common for them to refer to Zhou Enlai as representing more moderate policies and Li Lisan as being more radical. Although, as some of them admit, this is something of an oversimplification of the issues. Anyways, even though the idea didn't originate with him, Li Li San became a big fan of this idea of using the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom as a model for the Red Army, and strongly encouraged Mao to take up this way of organizing the army. Mao came to characterize this as the ideology of roving rebel bands. Mao highlights the way in which this conception of the Red Army downplays the political tasks of the army in a resolution that he drafted for a Congress of Communist Party members in the Fourth Red Army in December 1929. Part of this resolution later appeared as the document correcting mistaken ideas in the party in Mao's selected works. Here's what Mao wrote. Jumping into the middle of the document here, just to give you a sense of how Mao is characterizing these policies. Quote, "The ideology of roving rebel bands naturally cannot become the final forceful program of action of the Red Army. However, its influence still manifests itself strongly in all fields. For example, one, some people want to increase our political influence only by means of roving guerrilla actions, but are unwilling to increase it by undertaking the arduous task of helping the masses build up political power. Two, in expanding the organizational line of the Red Army, some people follow the line of expanding the Red Army by hiring men and buying horses and recruiting deserters and accepting mutineers, rather than the line of expanding the local Red Guards and the local troops and thus developing non-local forces of the Red Army. Some people lack the patience to carry on arduous struggles together with the masses and only want to go to the big cities to eat and drink to their heart's content. All these manifestations of roving rebelism seriously hamper the Red Army in performing the tremendous tasks imposed on it by the revolution. Consequently, the eradication of roving rebel ideology is an important objective in the ideological struggle within the party and in the Red Army. The methods of correction are as follows. Transform the incorrect ideas that have their basis in the vagrants in the party through education and eradicate the ideology of roving rebel bands. B. Intensify education among the basic sections of the Red Army and among recently recruited captives to counter the vagabond outlook. C. Attract activist workers and peasants experienced in struggle to the ranks of the Red Army so as to change its composition. D. Create new army units from among the masses of workers and peasants who are involved in the struggle. End quote. So this gives us some context for what Zhou Enlai is referring to here when he says that you must never follow the ways of the army of the Taiping Rebellion in his letter, and why this is significant as a major issue that's going to come back up in terms of how part of the communist leadership conceptualized the role of the Red Army. And we can see here Mao very strongly disagreed with this concept and felt that it depoliticized the army. Now, let's finish up Zhou's letter. Quote, "Under current conditions, we have decided to transfer Comrade Zhu De and Comrade Mao Zedong to the CC. The two comrades might feel reluctant to leave the army since they have worked in it for over a year. However, taking into consideration both the needs of the situation and the demands of our work, the CC believes that it is necessary for them to leave the army now. Zhu and Mao's departure will not cause the army any losses and will help it implement the plan to disperse its forces. If Zhu and Mao stay with the army, their activities will draw the enemy's attention, thus making it more difficult for us to disperse the troops. When Zhu and Mao come to the CC, they could introduce to our comrades all over the country their precious experience in leading a 10,000-strong armed force in dealing with the enemy for more than a year. This will make a greater contribution to the whole revolutionary cause. Therefore, as soon as comrades Zhu and Mao receive the CC decision, they should leave the army and come to the CC immediately. They must not neglect more important and difficult duties because of an emotional attachment to the soldiers in the army. In regard to the method of dispersing the forces and arranging for Zhu and Mao to leave the army, the Central Military Committee will send you a detailed plan. Of course, you should carry out the plan flexibly rather than implement it mechanically. the Hunan-Jiangxi Border Region Special Committee can continue to exist for a time, you may make decisions on how to reorganize it. This letter is sent to you via the party committees in Hunan, Jiangxi, and Guangdong. End quote. So, the order for Mao and Zhu to leave the army is the really big thing in this final section of the letter. What's going on here? Zhou Enlai makes the request somewhat diplomatically, as is his style of doing things. He gives some good reasons, or at least pretexts, for why Mao and Zhu might come to Shanghai. He says that the center will benefit from Mao and Zhu's experience. He says that the absence of Mao and Zhu will make the Red Army less of a target for the enemy. This would be an important consideration, especially if the army were now dispersed across the countryside because of the new orders that he had just given earlier in the letter. And he pleads with Mao and Zhu not to be emotional about the issue. But it's hard to escape the feeling that the main reason that Zhou wanted Mao and Zhu to go to Shanghai was so that the party center could attempt to exercise more direct control over the Red Army. This issue of the party center exercising control over Mao and Zhu, or at least over the army that they built, is going to be another recurring theme over the next few years. And as we've already seen in previous episodes, for example, with the Hunan Provincial Committee's attempts to exercise authority over the Fourth Red Army in 1928, this has actually already become an ongoing theme. After all, earlier in the letter, Zhou expressed his suspicions that Mao and Zhu were already insubordinate to the Central Committee when he wrote that either you did not receive this instruction or you are not willing to follow it. Zhou just does not seem confident that Mao and Zhu are going to follow instructions. And as we will see with Mao's reply of April 5th, 1929, he had good reason. We'll pick things up again next episode with Mao's very substantial reply.